This is International Edition. We go to the White House, where U.S. President Donald Trump is speaking about U.S. policy towards Iran.
With the long overdue step of imposing tough sanctions on Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The Revolutionary Guard is the Iranian Supreme Leader's corrupt personal terror force and militia. It has hijacked large portions of Iran's economy and seized massive religious endowments to fund war and terror abroad. This includes arming the Syrian dictator, supplying proxies and partners with missiles and weapons to attack civilians in the region, and even plotting to bomb a popular restaurant right here in Washington, D.C. I am authorizing the Treasury Department to further sanction the entire Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps for its support for terrorism and to apply sanctions to its officials, agents, and affiliates. I urge our allies to join us in taking strong actions to curb Iran's continued dangerous and destabilizing behavior, including thorough sanctions outside the Iran deal that target the regime's ballistic missile program in support for terrorism and all of its destructive activities, of which there are many. Finally, on the grave matter of Iran's nuclear program, since the signing of the nuclear agreement, the regime's dangerous aggression has only escalated. At the same time, it has received massive sanctions relief while continuing to develop its missiles program. Iran has also entered into lucrative business contracts with other parties to the agreement. When the agreement was finalized in 2015, Congress passed the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act to ensure that Congress's voice would be heard on the deal. Among other conditions, this law requires the president or his designee to certify that the suspension of sanctions under the deal is appropriate and proportionate to measure and other measures taken by Iran to terminate its illicit nuclear program. Based on the factual record I have put forward, I am announcing today that we cannot and will not make this certification. We will not continue down a path whose predictable conclusion is more violence, more terror, and the very real threat of Iran's nuclear breakout. That is why I am directing my administration to work closely with Congress and our allies to address the deal's many serious flaws so that the Iranian regime can never threaten the world with nuclear weapons. These include the deal's sunset clauses that in just a few years will eliminate key restrictions on Iran's nuclear program. The flaws in the deal also include insufficient enforcement and near total silence on Iran's missile programs. Congress has already begun the work to address these problems. Key House and Senate leaders are drafting legislation that would amend the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act to strengthen enforcement, prevent Iran from developing an internet, this is so totally important, an intercontinental ballistic missile, and make all restrictions on Iran's nuclear activity permanent under U.S. law. So important. I support these initiatives. However, in the event we are not able to reach a solution working with Congress and our allies, then the agreement will be terminated. It is under continuous review, and our participation can be canceled by me as president at any time. As we have seen in North Korea, the longer we ignore a threat, the worse that threat becomes. It is why we are determined that the world's leading sponsor of terrorism will never obtain nuclear weapons. In this effort, we stand in total solidarity with the Iranian regime's longest suffering victims, its own people. The citizens of Iran have paid a heavy price for the violence and extremism of their leaders. The Iranian people long to, and they just are longing to reclaim their country's proud history, its culture, its civilization, its cooperation with its neighbors. We hope that these new measures directed at the Iranian dictatorship will compel the government to reevaluate its pursuit of terror at the expense of its people. We hope that our actions today will help bring about a future of peace, stability, and prosperity in the Middle East, a future where sovereign nations respect each other and their own citizens. We pray for a future where young children, American and Iranian, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish, can grow up in a world free from violence, hatred, and terror. And until that blessed day comes, we will do what we must to keep America safe. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless America. Thank you.
That is President Donald Trump speaking at the White House about U.S. Strategy towards Iran. Well, I spoke with White House correspondent Peter Heinlein and asked him if this is a new policy towards Tehran.
Yes, it is. And I think that the Trump administration has been asked to put together something in line with what President Trump has been saying all along about his dissatisfaction with the agreement that the Obama administration entered into, along with the other members of the UN Security Council and the European Union, to limit Iran's nuclear program.
What kind of trigger points could cause, say, U.S. sanctions to be reimposed on Tehran?
I think if there's any indication that Iran is not complying with the terms of the deal called the JCPOA, that's the big deal that that Iran signed or that Iran entered into with the rest of with the P5 and the European Union, then Congress could act. And in fact, if they so choose, they could set these points so that they automatically snap back the sanctions that had been in place against Iran. Of course, not all of those, some of the sanctions are tough, but the main sanction that Iran wanted to get rid of, at least one of the main sanctions, was the money that was frozen. Their billions and billions of dollars that they now have access to. So in some respects, it would be closing the barn door after the cows are gone.
And what about possible congressional reaction to this?
I think reaction has been somewhat along partisan lines. Democrats and members of the Obama administration have been against any action that might lead to unraveling of this deal, because they point out that if the deal falls through, Iran is free to begin developing nuclear weapons right away. As it is, there's a sunset clause in the JCPOA that allows them only to start redeveloping their nuclear program after 8 to 10 years.
That's White House correspondent Peter Heinlein. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, I'm sure President Trump has just made this announcement, but I'm sure there's already reaction on social media.
Yeah, even though he just spoke about this, people are still pulling out some of the key quotes and key lines, and we're already beginning to see what I'm sure will continue to be a fierce debate between the Trump supporters who are kind of rallied by this. They said that this is a hardline approach that the U.S. needs to take, that Trump is delivering on a key campaign promise that he pledged that he would fulfill. So Trump's base is very pleased about this. Then you have his opponents who are very concerned. They said it's discarding diplomacy. There are a lot of fears about war and escalating tensions, geopolitical tensions. So this is a debate that is only just beginning. It's a debate that we've seen on just about every issue, any time that the White House comes up with anything, and not just in this administration, but in others as well. We see this back and forth. But for this instance, I think we're going to see a lot of conversation, not just today, but as this moves forward, about what this deal is, whether this is the right move, and where the U.S. goes from here regarding Iran.
Yeah.
Also trending today, other than the Iran story, which is really dominating things right now, is hashtag women boycott Twitter. Now, we talked about on yesterday's show, actress Rose McGowan was suspended on Twitter because she spoke out against Harvey Weinstein, the Hollywood producer accused of sexually harassing and assaulting multiple women, and actor Ben Affleck, who defended him. After she spoke out against them, she was suspended, and that caused an outrage. So it prompted this hashtag women boycott Twitter. Women are vowing to stay off of the social network for 24 hours to show that the power and the kind of the vacuum that's left when they're not speaking out, and as a way to protest the actions of Twitter. As one person said, not speaking out via this boycott actually makes women's voices louder. So that's certainly the hope from this campaign. Others are questioning the efficacy, saying, well, why are you using this hashtag if you're supposed to be off Twitter? It doesn't really make sense. But it remains to be seen whether it will have an impact. But certainly a lot of women making their voice heard by not using Twitter today. And finally, today is Friday the 13th here in the U.S., which is a day of traditionally bad luck and superstition. The fact that it falls on a Friday in October, which is the month of Halloween, kind of the spooky month, is kind of unusual, and a lot of people making a note of that. A lot of people watching their step, looking out for black cats, or trying not to walk under ladders, other things that are superstitious, trying to preserve their good luck and ward off any bad luck that might come to them today.
Sounds like a good idea.
Yes.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Rescuers use cadaver dogs to look for bodies in the ruins in the California fires. Two people are dead as Kenya's opposition mounts protests. Venezuelans vote Sunday in regional elections seen as tests for President Maduro and the opposition. And a Western family has left Pakistan after being held by the Afghan Taliban. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Swedish scientists have completed a study that suggests cold air temperatures can trigger heart attacks. The observational study spanned 16 years and involved more than 280,000 patients who were treated for heart attacks at a coronary care unit. The study's first author, Dr. Momon Mohammed from Sweden's Lund University, says their findings show a seasonal variation in the occurrence of heart attacks, with a decreasing number in the summer but peaking in winter. Along with the medical data provided by the Swedish Myocardial Infarction Registry, the scientists also referred to local data gathered by hundreds of weather stations across Sweden to cross-reference conditions when the heart attacks occurred. Dr. Mohammed says the team's results consistently showed a higher occurrence of heart attacks in sub-zero temperatures. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. There's a new richest man in China, and it's not real estate magnate Wang Jialin of the Dalian Wanda Group. It's 39-year-old real estate developer Xu Jiayin, chairman of China Evergrande Group, who's worth an estimated $43 billion. The Harun Report, which was formed in 1999, is out with its 2017 list of the country's rich and famous. Luxembourg-born Rupert Hujwerf is chairman and chief researcher of the Harun Report. Speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty from Shanghai, Hujwerf said for the 12th time in 19 years, there's a new number one richest person in China, underscoring the dynamic nature of wealth in the world's second largest economy. He said Xu's rise has been meteoric.
He's probably one of the fastest growers ever in China. In terms of his wealth went up $30 billion pretty much in the last 6 months. And that's on the back of more than doubling his sales in real estate.
Rupert, he's chairman of a group called China Evergrande Group. What's that all about?
China Evergrande is a real estate developer. It's building houses. They've been one of the fastest growing real estate developments in China. What's interesting is that they, this year, for the second time, broke into the global 500 in terms of their sales, which I think is hitting above $50 billion. So that's a lot of houses that they've been selling. The boss, Xu Jiayin, he's got about 70% of the listed company.
Rupert, you say that it's been a good year in China for manufacturing, cars, education, TMT, and healthcare. What do you mean?
On this year's Harun China Rich List, we've got 2,000 people. The main source of wealth has been manufacturing for about one-third, followed by real estate, followed by IT, finance, investments, and healthcare. The big trend is that manufacturing for the last 5 years has been going up, so there are more people doing manufacturing. Real estate has been going down. There are less people doing real estate, and I suppose in real estate, what's happened is that it's become more centralized. It's become less fragmented as an industry. Manufacturing, well, China's very much been a sort of the manufacturing capital of the world. And they're now sort of trying to develop from traditional manufacturing to advanced manufacturing. And we're seeing some really fascinating changes there. There's a lot of new businesses developing. For example, in healthcare, there's a company called Wuxi Pharma. That is a company that's just gone public in the last year. They have 8,000 employees who have got doctorates and above, which is pretty amazing. Of the 22 drugs approved last year by the FDA, 16 of them were researched by this company called Wuxi Pharma.
Rupert, what about some of the familiar faces, people like Alibaba Group Holdings, Jack Ma, and property magnate Wang Jianlin? Where are they?
Wang Jianlin has not had a great year. His wealth has sort of dropped from first place down to fifth place, but he's still right up there with sort of $20 billion or so. Jack Ma from Alibaba has had a very special year. Alibaba's stock has doubled over the last year, yet his wealth has remained static. And that's because he's got a subsidiary affiliate called Ant Financial, where his shares have gone down from 35% to just over 1%, which means that had he kept all those shares, he'd still be number one in China. But instead, we have almost 50 people from Alibaba Group who now made the Harun China Rich List this year, which is an absolute shattering of the record of number of individuals from any particular organization.
Rupert Hujwerf said another man to watch is Tencent Holdings IT entrepreneur Pony Ma, who has seen his firm's value rise on the popularity of its WeChat messaging app and popular online games. Ma has taken on a 5% stake in Elon Musk's Tesla electric vehicle company. In a country with large state-owned enterprises, he said those on the rich list have become increasingly important to the Chinese economy, accounting for 6% of the country's total tax revenue and employing up to 1.5% of the entire Chinese workforce. The list of 2,130 individuals accounts for no less than a combined $2.6 trillion in wealth. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. The Boy Scouts of America announced it will begin accepting girls in 2018, marking a dramatic change in the organization and drawing criticism from the Girl Scouts, who will have to compete for members. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports, the changes are a welcome development for those historically connected to the Boy Scouts organization in the hometown of its founder.
All the different eagles.
When former executive Matt Skelly was coming up through the ranks of the Boy Scouts of America in his youth, achieving the rank of Eagle Scout was the ultimate accomplishment.
Only 4% right now earn the rank of Eagle Scout. It is a high honor, and a lot of people put a lot of stock in, you know, becoming an Eagle Scout.
More than 2.4 million young men like Skelly have made Eagle Scout. But sometime in the not-too-distant future, this elite fraternity will mark the moment the first female joins their ranks.
And I think it's just kind of a natural progression.
Skelly, who lives in Ottawa, Illinois, the hometown of W.D. Boyce, the founder of the Boy Scouts of America, says the decision to widely accept girls into the organization isn't a surprise to him because they've already been involved in other scouting programs like Explorers and Venture Scouts.
Girls and young women have been part of the scouting program at an advanced age, like 14 and up, for a long time.
He's also not surprised some people would oppose the move, because he's heard it before.
I go back to the 1980s when women were first allowed to be scout leaders. And I remember as a kid, people, oh my, you know, the program's going to go down. But it only strengthened the program, as it did with Rotary when they allowed women in. And I think you have to be able to change as a program.
I wasn't given any grief.
Molly Perot, who now serves as the executive director of the Ottawa Historical and Scouting Heritage Museum, which honors Boyce's legacy, was one of the first women to volunteer as a scout leader in the 1980s.
I know one lady in this particular area was the first lady scout master. I think she took a little bit of ribbon from the guys, but I never had any problem with it.
While she is unsure how Boyce, who died in 1929, would welcome the changes to the organization he founded, she points out while Boyce lived in a very different time, the principles and spirit of the movement are still the same, regardless of gender.
And I always said when I was a leader, if I could get a kid to live by the scout oath and law, I figured they were one of the finest human beings on the face of the earth. I still believe that. If you can get girls to do that, I think the same thing.
Matt Skelly says the Boy Scouts still have a lot to work out before they start welcoming girls into the organization. But he's looking forward to new opportunities, not just for himself as a volunteer, but also his family.
Provides me an opportunity now, in all honesty, that I'll be able to do the Cub Scouting and Boy Scouting program eventually.
Girl, drop, go.
With my daughter.
An opportunity for her that opens up in 2018. Kane Faraba, VOA News.
Go!
Ottawa, Illinois.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Countering Hezbollah is a top priority for the United States. In a recent briefing, Ambassador-at-Large and Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales announced rewards for two senior Hezbollah leaders under the State Department's Rewards for Justice program. The United States is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information that leads to the location, arrest, or conviction in any country of Talal Hamia. Hamia has been linked to several terrorist attacks, hijackings, and kidnappings targeting U.S. citizens. Hamia leads Hezbollah's International Terrorist Unit, the so-called External Security Organization, which is responsible for planning and conducting terrorist attacks outside of Lebanon. These attacks have targeted primarily Americans and Israelis. The U.S. is also offering a reward of up to $5 million for information that leads to the location, arrest, or conviction in any country of Fuad Shukr. Shukr is a senior military commander of Hezbollah's forces in Lebanon. He's also a member of the Jihad Council, Hezbollah's highest military body. Shukr plays a key role in Hezbollah's military operations in Syria, and he helped plan and launch the 1983 attack on the U.S. Marine Corps barracks in Beirut that killed 241 Marines. If you have any information about either of these two men, please contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or email info@rewardsforjustice.net. Absolute confidentiality is assured and relocation may be available. These are the first Hezbollah-related rewards under the Rewards for Justice program in a decade. This announcement is just one part of the effort to counter Hezbollah's terrorist activities, said Ambassador Sales. Until Hezbollah stops using terrorism and violence to achieve its goals, the United States and our allies will aggressively target its terrorism infrastructure and financial support networks.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.